So let's get started. Let me introduce our speakers. First, we have John Bruce. He is a partner at BKD, and he's San Antonio's tax director, and he's also a healthcare tax partner for the firm, which the firm is a national firm. And I apologize for the noise behind me. I'll put me on mute real quick. They're doing some work on the street outside. I have known John for many years when he was a shareholder with a local firm, the Hanke Group, which merged with BKD. So he's been with the same firm, so to speak, from August 1999, which would be almost 21 and a half years. So his resume is real short. It's just, he hasn't moved around very much at all. John received his bachelor's degree in accounting from St. Mary's University. Cameron Weldon is a managing director in the San Antonio office of BKD. He has over 14 years of experience helping owners of private businesses navigate complex tax and accounting matters. Cameron is a graduate at Baylor University with a BBA in accounting and a master's in of taxation degree. He has served as a part-time lecturer in taxation at the University of Texas, San Antonio. I've never had the pleasure of shaking Cameron's hand as he went to work for BKD in April. So we all know where we were then. Actually, John knew Cameron and convinced him to move from the firm he was with to BKD. And I have only met Cameron face-to-face via Zoom, and we've had several meetings via Zoom. So one day I'll get to shake your hand, Cameron. I'm going to
certainly hope so.
And go ahead. It's all yours.
Okay. Well, thank you for the introductions there, Linda. Thanks for getting up and wanting to hear about taxes at 9 a.m. I'm not sure I like to hear about taxes at 9 a.m. So, I think I titled the presentation kind of unique tax considerations really for a unique year. And that's probably an understatement would be to call this a unique year. But the good news is, I guess I need to share my screen here, don't I? All right. Can you see that presentation?
Yep. You're all good. Right.
The good news is, I suppose, is that 2020 is just around the corner, ready or not. I think probably more of us are more ready than not, although maybe anxiously awaiting some of the changes that could be lurking around that corner. 2020's given us a new presidential administration and an unknown congressional control. And so as we think about taxes here at year end, we have probably more unknowns than we have knowns. And that can be a little frustrating to work through from a planning perspective. So before we close the door here on 2020, we kind of just want to pause here and talk very high level. We could spend a whole day talking about these topics if we wanted to get into greater detail. So we're going to keep it very high level, hopefully maybe jog a few questions for you, a few thoughts for you. And then certainly we've provided our contact information as well as the links to a few resources at the end of our presentation and sent a copy of the presentation to Linda if you want to distribute that to the participants afterwards. But we really want to pause and kind of look at three things. COVID legislation. We had kind of a whole flurry of activity at the beginning of the year, and that provided us for a lot of change. Right after we got over tax reform and maybe started to feel like we were a little bit more comfortable with it, some changes showed up really in about a 10-day time span. It happened really, really quickly. As a part of those same bills that were passed in late March, we had a couple of funding programs, both of which have a strong potential to impact your 2020 taxes. And so John's going to talk a little bit about those. And then, of course, we can't wrap up without maybe talking a little bit about what impact might the election results have on our taxes going forward, knowing that it's a whole lot of hearsay. And unfortunately, our Georgia runoff, which will really determine that congressional control, won't happen until January. So we're left with our absolute best guess at this point. So maybe before we jump in, let's just pause real quick and talk about what is year-end tax planning. I think a lot of people think about taxes as a set of forms that they dread dealing with in the spring, or dread it so much that they extend it and deal with it in the fall. And that is, that's really what taxes is really reporting income and deductions, but there really can and should be so much more to it. Really, year-end planning is about hitting the pause button before the year wraps up and trying to review your tax and your financial matters to really take advantage of any benefits that exist, with the ultimate goal of reducing your tax burden, keeping in mind that may not be your current year tax burden. You want to think about taxes as kind of over a continuum of time, and what's your kind of total tax burden, as opposed to thinking about it just in 12-month increments, because as we'll talk about whenever we think through some of the potential changes coming, that may end up costing you more tax in the long run. And that just gives you really the chance to evaluate where you are on your overall taxes and really where you are in your business or where you are personally with your overall financial situation. And then as we'll talk about, it really gives you the chance to plan for those tax liabilities. Instead of filing that tax return and kind of blindly opening up to the page where it shows how much you owe, why not go ahead and anticipate that and help control some of that well in advance, if at all possible. So as we jump into maybe talking about some of the COVID legislation that occurred early in the year, I think it's worthwhile to kind of visit the journey that I think taxes have been over the last couple of years, because this time, I guess about 3 years ago, Congress was in a flurry of activity, trying to think through really what President Trump's kind of landmark legislation would end up being, which is what we now call tax reform. It was called the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. It was passed in late 2017, and most of those provisions went into effect with the tax year 2018. And so most tax accountants really spent 2018 with our head in the sand, trying to ignore the fact that the laws were changing, until late in the year as we started thinking about the 2018 filing season going into 2019. And so that kicked off about a year and a half of really trying to figure out what was some pretty complex changes. Ironically, politicians always say they want to simplify the tax code. And anytime a politician says that, you should just assume it's about to get more complex, because in their efforts to simplify it, it just gets more complicated. And so the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act really had a couple of focuses. I think one was they wanted to lower the corporate tax rate. One of the big items of discussion in the last presidential election was just that the U.S. corporate tax rate was too high in the global community. And at the same time, wanted to deliver tax cuts for individuals. And by doing that, introduced a brand new deduction for flow-through entities for qualified business income. And then at the same time, to help balance out how much the overall legislation costs, introduced a few new limitations, both on business deductions and individual deductions, all with the goal of lowering the overall tax burden to businesses, with individuals kind of being a secondary beneficiary to that. Well, then, as we know, early 2020, enter COVID-19 into the U.S., the world effectively shuts down in mid-March. I remember there was a Wall Street Journal headline, and I should have kept it so that I could show it to my grandkids one day, but it said, "Today, Earth is closed," right? And literally, Earth was closed. And so at that point, the entire objective kind of flipped on its head, and it really became about infusing cash into the economy as quickly and as efficiently as possible. And so we had a couple of, or two very large bills that were really passed within about 10 days of each other. The Families First Coronavirus Response Act passed March 18th. And this was really more focused on testing and some of the logistics of just kind of navigating COVID. But it did create a couple of payroll tax benefits for paid sick leave, and then also that's the first bill that really enhanced unemployment benefits on a go-forward basis. And then just about 9-10 days later, the CARES Act, or the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, was passed on March 27th, and this was the really, really big expensive bill, right? So next time you feel like you went on a spending spree, just remember Congress spent about $3 trillion in 10 days. So you've got a ways to go to catch up to them. And this created the PPP loan program, the Paycheck Protection Program, and which I think most people are at least aware of, if didn't take advantage of it. And then it also created a number of tax provisions, and we'll highlight a few of those here momentarily. Also created the Provider Relief Fund, which John is going to talk a little bit about how that might impact taxes here going into year end. So as I mentioned, the COVID legislation really became so much more about how do we infuse cash, right? So the Paycheck Protection Program, as we know, was kind of riddled with a lot of lack of guidance. Even the $1,200 economic incentive payments out to individuals really came without a lot of guidance. And the theme was Congress cared less about the how and more about the just do it, right? Just get money into the economy as quickly as we possibly can. And so we saw that in the way that the taxes were changed, really for tax years 2018 through 2020. Back when the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, their tax reform was passed, there were some significant changes to the way losses could either carry forward or carry back. Prior to that, losses could be carried back 2 years and claimed for a potential refund, and Tax Cuts and Jobs Act eliminated that. So there were no longer carry back of losses. The losses could be carried forward indefinitely, but then there was also an annual limitation on how much loss could be used. You could only offset 80% of your current year income with a loss carry forward. Well, fast forward to the world closing, and the CARES Act kind of retroactively to 2018 changed that such that losses could now be carried back up to 5 years. And then the 80% annual limitation was suspended for the years 2018 through 2020. So again, in the theme of getting cash out there for those businesses that were already losing money, then there was the opportunity to maybe go back and reclaim some tax dollars from a prior year. And the biggest opportunity that exists out there is within that five-year carryback, keeping in mind that tax rates changed beginning in 2018, but you could carry a 2018 loss back to 2013. And so that would give you the potential to carry that loss back into a year where your tax rate was significantly higher. And so there was actually a pretty, almost a permanent tax benefit if you had paid tax back in those years. And so it really left the opportunity to strongly review 2018, 2019, and then plan in 2020 with the goal in mind of maximizing those losses, keeping in mind that sometimes we can generate a tax loss without there really being maybe a true economic loss. Really reviewing those, amending your 18 and 19 returns if there's opportunities that exist in order to be able to carry those losses back and generate those cash payments out to the taxpayers. So then, how do we do that, right? What are a couple of things that we should consider? How do we maximize those losses? One thing was the CARES Act actually provided a correction that we've all been waiting for really since early 2018. So the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act created what we call 100% bonus depreciation. So depreciation is when you buy a capital asset, piece of equipment, piece of furniture, a building, and you capitalize that cost. You don't deduct it in the year you purchased it, but you capitalize it and you depreciate it. And so for certain classes of assets, generally lives of 15 years or less would be eligible for what's called 100% bonus depreciation, meaning for tax purposes, you effectively do deduct it in the year that you purchased that asset. But there was a small hiccup in the bill. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act had intended to create a class of assets called qualified improvement property, which is really non-structural interior changes to a commercial property. So if you were to own a building, lease a building, buy a building, and you were to make kind of an interior build out, right? Build out walls and kind of build it out so that it's a usable space at that point. Those interior improvements, as long as they didn't expand the size of the building or create any structural changes, would be qualified improvement property. But What happens whenever you write bills at 2 a.m. and pass them on a Saturday morning is things get left out. And that's what happens with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And so it required a literal act of Congress to fix that. Congress was kind of on again, off again, really from the time they passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act up until the CARES Act, about whether or not they wanted to pass that, whether or not they were going to pass that. Well, it took a global pandemic to kind of kick them off the ledge. And in the CARES Act, they gave us that technical correction that we needed. So it gives you the opportunity, if you had those qualified improvement additions in 2018 or 2019, even if you've already filed your return, you have the option to go back and amend that return in order to take bonus depreciation, or you can file what's known as an accounting method change. You would file that with your next timely filed return, so presumably your 2020 tax return. And then you would be able to take the kind of a big catch-up deduction on your 2020 tax return. So you have the opportunity to be strategic about what year you want to put that deduction in order to then potentially, if that were to help you generate a tax loss, carry that back and refund some tax dollars from an earlier year. Another thing that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act created, and this was one of those that was kind of meant to help pay for tax reform, was created what was known as the excess business loss limitation. So individuals who own partnerships and S corporations, all of their share of that income comes onto their personal tax return and subject to a whole variety of limitations, ultimately is reported and the tax is paid at the individual or the taxpayer level. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act created a limitation such that if you were to receive losses allocated to you from those business activities, you could only deduct up to a certain amount on an annual basis, and then any excess would carry forward. And that was originally set at $250,000 for a single taxpayer or $500,000 for a married filing joint taxpayer. And the CARES Act went back and retroactively, so 2018 through 2020, essentially eliminated or suspended that limitation. So taxpayers that maybe were subject to that limitation in 2018 or 2019 should consider going back, amending those returns for those years. And it shifts it really from an excess business loss limitation to now kind of an overall potential loss. So there's the strong possibility of a refund either of 18 and 19 taxes, or if you end up with a net loss overall, then take advantage of the carryback provisions. Additionally, and this is somewhat of a narrow limitation, but the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act created a limitation for large businesses. And initially, large businesses was any business over $25 million in annual revenue. It limited the interest expense deduction to 30% of adjusted taxable income. For very simple purposes, let's call it adjusted taxable income, really EBITDA, or earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, in amortization. The CARES Act for 2019 and 20 for corporations has made that a 50% limitation, so increase the amount that we could potentially deduct. And then for partnerships, increase that for 2020. And so again, if you have already filed your 19 return or subject to that limitation, it certainly warrants going back, revisiting whether or not the increase in the limitation might have benefited you, and if so, filing an amended return. And then lastly, is really just taking this chance to review your overall accounting methods. However you keep your books internally or for financial statement reporting purposes doesn't necessarily have to match how you file your income tax return. The tax code is tens of thousands of pages long, and embedded within that is a whole host of accounting methods that we can consider that really with the goal of kind of doing one of two things. It's accelerating deductions into the current year or deferring income into the next year. Now, keep in mind, we'll wrap up at the end talking about some of the tax legislation that may come down with a new administration. And I'm going to tell you to consider doing the exact opposite, right? So that's where thinking of taxes less about a 12-month period and more about many years at a time really becomes important in this particular situation, because we don't want to accelerate deductions and defer income, and the next year tax rates jump up significantly, and we wish we had accelerated income and deferred deductions. So you have to be strategic when you think about these things. Both of the COVID legislations created tax credits. The Family First Coronavirus Relief Act, which was the very first one, created an employment tax credit. And it's a pretty narrow, pretty specific credit, but it's really focused on if you continue to pay employees that were either sick because of COVID or needed time off because they were all of a sudden stay-at-home homeschool parents and they were not anticipating that, then there is a employment tax credit. If you think you qualify for that, I would suggest BKD has a tool that can help you think through what the qualification is and what the calculation is, or certainly consult your tax advisor about it. And then the Employee Retention Credit was created by the CARES Act. And this was really focused on employers that continued to pay wages while they were financially impacted by COVID due to either a full or partial suspension. So this would be for an organization that, you know, maybe was required to close down. They weren't considered an essential service, but yet they continued to pay wages to employees. Again, pretty narrow set of circumstances, very focused on employers under 500 total employees. And then it's also important to note that you're not eligible for that credit if you received a PPP loan. So you either participated in the Paycheck Protection Program, or if not, then you can review whether or not this credit makes sense for you. And then one last point to just kind of wedge in here. I'm in Texas. Texas franchise and federal taxes are somewhat decoupled from each other. But if you have a footprint that requires filings outside of the state of Texas, then you have to be mindful that state income taxes start by using federal income, federal taxable income, but then there's many, many adjustments that can happen from there. And it's particularly important to review that this year because states may or may not conform with the CARES Act, and that actually seems to be a moving target. Early on, a lot of states didn't conform. As time has passed, more and more states have begun to conform. But for example, the accelerated depreciation on the qualified improvement property, while that may be an accelerated deduction for federal income tax purposes, may not be an accelerated deduction for state income tax purposes. And unfortunately, there's 43 states with an income tax and 43 states that have all separate individual laws and regulations. And so you have to look at each state individually and really understand what the rules are there. And then just one last point that I threw in at the bottom there, and that is the idea of remote working has the potential to create a big headache from a state income tax perspective. There was actually an article in the Wall Street Journal within the last 2 weeks about this very topic. Individuals, by providing services in a state, are likely subject to state income tax wherever they were sitting. Now, of course, in Texas, we don't have a personal or individual income tax, but if I chose to pack up and head to Colorado for the last 9 months, then I likely have a Colorado income tax responsibility. And then the further complication of that is that businesses generally have a filing responsibility wherever they have a physical presence. And a physical presence is certainly having an employee located in that state. So not only have I, if I pack up and head to Colorado for not the last 9 months, not only have I potentially created a tax headache for me that I may or may not have anticipated, but I've also probably created a tax headache for my employer who may or may not have anticipated that. And so revisiting your state taxes, particularly if you had employees scatter across the country and pack their laptops and go with them, I think is a valuable exercise before states come knocking. And states were desperate for money before 2020, and now they're going to scratch and claw for anything they can get. So I'm going to pass it over to John, and John's going to focus on kind of the two big funding programs and particularly how those can impact your 2020 taxes.
Thank you, Cameron. Linda, is this where I should start telling the jokes? So I was just going to comment and say, you know, you should probably never have a tax presentation like right after lunch. So I think early in the morning while we're all caffeinated is a good idea. So, I want to talk about, you know, the two things here. And obviously, you know, probably the biggest thing that occurred this year for those of us in our world anyway, is the PPP loans or Paycheck Protection Program loans. And, you know, a lot of information, a lot of publicity out there in the news about this program, you know, and these were loans for employers with less than 500 employees. However, there was a lot of exceptions there as well for, you saw it in the news, big chain restaurants that had, you know, less than 500 employees per locations. They were also eligible. And the primary purpose of these loans was for these companies to be able to maintain their payroll, keep their employees off of unemployment while they were either shut down or negatively impacted by the coronavirus. In the statute of the CARES Act, Congress said that the loans were going to be forgivable if you met certain criteria on the backside. Basically that you didn't cut your employees' pay and you didn't lay off a bunch of employees, okay? They said, so long as you kind of meet those criteria, the loan is potentially eligible to be forgiven, and that forgiveness is not taxable income. So that's what the intention was, that the forgiveness of that loan was not taxable income. So the IRS gets a hold of that, and a couple of weeks ago on November 18, 2020, put out Revenue Ruling 2020-27 and Revenue Procedure 2020-51, and clarified that based on Congress saying the forgiveness of the loan is not taxable income, therefore it's tax exempt income, and expenses associated with tax exempt income are not deductible under Section 265. So what it in a sense does, it basically effectively just makes the forgiveness of the loan taxable income, okay? This has a huge impact. I can tell you, if there's other accountants on the call here, has a huge impact in looking at the end of this year, whether or not those expenses can be deductible or not. And it's actually, I'll tell you what it's doing, it's actually hurting businesses, because they're looking at this and saying, you know, especially depending on what type of entity you're in, if you're in a C corporation, you know, you're looking at either paying a truckload of corporate tax or passing out a bunch of year-end bonuses when you really don't want to pass out year-end bonuses. You'd rather have your company hang on to the cash, because, you know, still a lot of headwinds coming in 2021. So, you know, it's been batted around recently in some of the negotiations that there may be a fix coming that would make these expenses deductible. You know, I would tell you, I wouldn't bet any money out of my wallet on that. But I do think it's possible that we get something, you know, but if we don't get something before the end of the year, it's really going to complicate what we're helping our clients with here at the end of the year. So more than likely we would maybe get something, you know, what do you think, Nerman, about March 13th of next year?
Feels about right. Yeah.
So, the non-deductibility of the expenses, and here's what the IRS put out in the two pronouncements a couple of weeks ago, is that if my business has a reasonable expectation that my loan is going to be forgiven, then I cannot deduct those expenses, whether or not I've applied for forgiveness or not. Okay? Now, I have quite a few clients that have already applied for forgiveness and already been granted full forgiveness on their loans. I have other clients who have already applied for forgiveness, don't have the answers yet. And then I have some clients who haven't even applied yet. I talked to one client the other day that said their bank is still not ready to take their application. But it goes down to, do we have a reasonable expectation of that loan being forgiven? And I can tell you, most likely the answer is, if that loan was under $2 million, it's probably going to be all forgiven. One of the other things I've talked to a lot of my clients about is that, look, if you're doing your own forgiveness application, and if you're not getting 100% of this loan forgiven, you're probably doing something wrong. Because when the government came in and extended the covered period from 8 weeks to 24 weeks, even if you had a pretty significant cut in your FTE counts, you probably still are going to be able to get 100% of that loan forgiven. So if our loan is under 2 million, we have a reasonable expectation that it's going to be forgiven, then we cannot or should not deduct those expenses paid with those loan proceeds on our 2020 return. If you've got more than a $2 million loan, you may have a possibility of deferring that non-deductibility if you think you're at risk for not having that loan forgiven. You know, if you're over $2 million in this loan, then the government, there's extra scrutiny to test whether you needed the loan or not. And so there is more uncertainty if your loan was over $2 million, but if it's under $2 million, you're deemed to have needed it. You're deemed to have met the need criteria. So over $2 million, there may be some wiggle room there to potentially deduct those expenses in 2020 if we think the loan might not be forgiven. If you're in that kind of a situation, you should definitely talk with your tax advisor, because that gets very complicated and has a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, and keeping in mind too that even if you deduct them in 2020, you may have to then add them back in 2021 once it is truly forgiven.
Right.
So it'd exactly. be a timing issue only.
Yep. As we talked just a minute ago, I mean, it's going to take Congress to come in and correct something potentially, you know, on the bipartisan bill that they're working on now. It's a possibility. I know in some of the earlier proposals, there were provisions in there to make these expenses deductible. I have not heard whether that's in there or not on the bill that they're currently working on. Obviously, you know, this may lead us to extending the return this year if we don't know the final answer by March or April, whenever our taxes are due, which helps somewhat, but it doesn't necessarily help with 1231, which is right around the corner. Right? For a lot of our clients, we got to figure out what to do here before the end of the year. It's kind of interesting that a couple of things are happening with I would say probably a lot of business. I mean, you've got some businesses, you know, businesses that are in the hospitality, restaurant, hotel, travel, you know, those type of industries. I mean, those businesses are decimated, right? They are really hurting. Got other businesses that are doing okay. You know, maybe their revenue's down a little bit, 10% over what it was in 19, but they're doing okay. And what's happened is that they were eligible and they received this one-time infusion of cash under the PPP loan program, plus everybody cut expenses, right? There's no travel. There's, you know, people cut advertising. I mean, people really cut their overhead. And so a lot of businesses are out there actually, you know, when you take this PPP loan into account, are having a pretty darn good year. So there is a lot of lobbying going up to Congress to try to get these expenses to be deductible. Again, yet to be seen if that'll pan out or not. Okay, another area of total confusion that does impact the healthcare industry big time is these provider relief funds. Okay, there were several tranches of these funds. Initially, I found out about this because I forget what day it was. I could probably go back to my email and look, but a client emailed me and said, "Hey, John, I just got X amount of dollars direct deposited into my account, and it says HHS funding or something like that. And it's, you know, I don't know, $50,000. Do you know what that is?" And I'm like, "No, what is that?" 30 minutes later, I get another email. I mean, the government just direct deposited into healthcare providers and institutions, bank accounts, you know, a calculation if they were providing services under Medicare they ran a calculation and just directly funded these provider relief funds into our clients' accounts. These funds were meant to cover, if you'll go to the next one, Cameron, they were meant to cover COVID-related expenses and lost revenues. Okay. When the funds first came out, it was pretty simple, high level. As Cameron mentioned before, they didn't really worry about the how so much. They were just passing money out. So these funds meant to cover COVID-related expenses and lost revenue. Well, I think we got some guidance that came out along the way about how we're supposed to report on this. We ended up getting guidance out. Gosh, I forget the dates now. I think at the end of September, and then a couple of weeks later, it changed again. And so what we know now, and I'll tell you, if you ask five different people, you may get five different answers on this. Okay. What we know now and what our opinion is that you basically run through two steps here. Okay. So if you're a provider of healthcare and you receive these monies, okay, let's say, for example, I'm a provider and I received $100,000 under this program. Okay. Well, step one is I have to look and see, do I have healthcare related expenses associated with the coronavirus? In other words, and those are meant to be incremental expenses. So did I have to spend extra money on PPE, extra money cleaning my office, extra money buying equipment to circulate the air in my office? Things that we can specifically identify are directly related and incremental to the coronavirus. Okay, that's my step one. Okay. Let's say in my example, I received $100,000 of funds and I've got $20,000 that I can identify in those expenses through 12/31 of 20, $20,000. Okay. Then I've got to look at my unused or my lost revenue. Okay. Here's where it gets a little complicated. So I look at my lost revenue from 2019 calendar year to 2020 calendar year, full year is what they're going to make us report. Okay. Let's say my revenue decreased, patient care revenue decreased by $500,000. So you would think, okay, well, John, you said you received $100,000, you spent 20 on expenses, and now your revenue is down $500,000. So of course you're going to be able to keep the 100. Well, not so quick. If I received a PPP loan of $500,000, that funding counts against my lost revenue. So now my lost revenue is zero. And so through 12/31/20, I'm only looking at, I can only keep $20,000 of those provider relief funds. Now, I think I might be already on the next slide. I'm not sure. Yeah, so the other part of this is that they've come out and said, if I don't earn these funds by 12/31 of 2020, they're gonna let me keep the monies and I could potentially earn those funds through June 30th of 2021. Same formula. So I'll look at my COVID-related expenses and my lost revenues. So here's something to think about. Let's say my lost revenues are down again, and we're gonna compare January to June of 2021 compared to January to June of 2019. So now if I have a drop in revenue, I don't have the PPP funding in 2021, theoretically I might be able to use those, I might be able to earn that, it's basically a grant, right? I might be able to earn that grant and keep those funds. Couple of things to think about on here is that for a tax basis cash payer, right, these monies are taxable when received. So right now, if I receive this $100,000 and I don't think I've, I don't have my, let's say my revenues are up and I didn't spend any, I don't have really any expenses related to COVID, I might want to consider sending that money back here before the end of the year. Otherwise, I'm going to have to pay tax on it if I'm a cash basis taxpayer this year, and then I'd get a deduction for it next year if I sent it back next year. So again, something to consider here at the end of the year. If I'm an accrual basis taxpayer, I may have a way around that through the 1 year deferral where I may not have to pay tax on that money in 2020. And for large providers that received over $750,000 of these funds, it will require a single audit for government funds in excess of $750,000, which is going to be a big, arduous process if you've not had single audits before. That's typically for tax-exempt organizations, but this will be for taxable organizations as well if they received over $750,000 in this funding. So this one, I can tell you, between these two programs, I bet, you know, over the last 6 or 8 months, I've spent a couple hundred hours reading, talking to clients, having conference calls, trying to figure out what is the government trying to tell us to do here? What is our reporting requirements? Do we get to keep this money? Do we not get to keep this money? And there is a ton of confusion out there. I think we've pretty well got the PPP program figured out, but this provider relief funds, there is a ton of confusion out there. And it's not easy. All right, what do we got next, Cameron?
Yeah, and right about the time John thought he figured out the rules, they would send out new rules. So yeah.
On Friday evenings at like 7 o'clock.
So maybe we'll have a follow-up in a week from now and we'll tell you different rules.
It might be, yeah.
Well, let's wrap up the time here and then we'll leave some time at the end for questions. But I don't know if you heard, there was an election in early November, and it sounds like we have a new administration coming January of 2021. And that new administration certainly published some thoughts around what they thought should happen to the tax code once they became president. And then, of course, you throw in a little bit of drama in that the Democrats lost a little bit of their majority in the House. And then we are currently waiting on what happens in Georgia to find out who has ultimate control of the Senate. Generally speaking, if the Republicans retain control of the Senate, you can probably assume that the next 10 minutes is truly just hearsay. I can't imagine that rogue block allows much of this to get through. But then to John's point earlier on, you know, we have spent a significant amount of money in the trillions upon trillions of dollars this year. One would presume that there's got to be a payback at some point, and certainly revenue generation might have to be part of that.
Yeah, so, Cameron, yep. If I could just kick in as well, another thing to consider with new legislation, even if Republicans do control the Senate, is through, you know, just like we got tax reform passed through the budget reconciliation process, if we're primarily raising taxes and raising revenue, that's a possibility that could get through without both sides agreeing.
Absolutely. So what is the overall theme? Higher tax rates. I mean, that's just kind of the overall theme. And keeping in mind that the tax rates that we have in kind of this post tax reform era are really some of the lowest tax rates we've ever had in the United States. Going back 40, 50 years ago, you know, some of the highest taxpayers were paying 70, 75% of certain amounts of their income. Right now, 37% is really the highest tax rate. Before the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the corporate tax rate was all the way up to 35%. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act cut that to 21%. The Biden proposal takes that back up to 28%. So effectively splitting the difference, and likely or still is a pretty competitive tax rate in the global economy. As I mentioned, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act created this kind of qualified business income deduction. It's subject to a number of limitations, but for the most part, if you have non-service related qualified business income, you can qualify for that deduction regardless of how much you make. This is the first time you're going to see that $400,000 number. $400,000 and up is really kind of the threshold that Biden has locked in on. At that point, you would completely phase out of any flow-through deduction. As far as incentives go, the real estate world has really grown immensely because of the tax code. And you can see in the crosshairs a little bit the real estate industry. Right now, like-kind exchanges occur, meaning I can sell a piece of property and within a certain time window go out and buy what's called a replacement property. So I have to get another piece of real property, and I can defer the gain on the sale of the original property. And that, again, has been proposed that that would be completely eliminated for taxpayers over $400,000. So again, the theme here is going to be higher taxes, especially if you make more than $400,000. As far as capital recovery, so bonus depreciation and expanded deductibility of capital expenses, like we mentioned, there's 100% bonus currently. And the Biden proposal would reverse that back to really just normal depreciation rules, and then also would take us back to the loss rules that we knew before the CARES Act. That's not a real big surprise. Actually, January 1 of 21, we go back to the old loss rules anyways. The CARES Act only extended through the end of this year. And so that's really not a major change. Individuals, the tax rates really aren't set to go up too much, really just kind of go back up to where they were prior to our most recent tax reform. But again, the focus here, at least in kind of all the discussion and all the campaign rhetoric, has really been focusing on those individuals or families making more than $400,000. And then the big thing that's really been a big discussion item is really what's going to happen with capital gains. Capital gains have very, very preferential rates, anywhere from 15% up to 20%. And then there is a surtax called the net investment income tax. So really 23, let's just call it 24% is kind of your maximum rate on capital gains. So even if you're in the highest tax bracket, paying 37% on your income, the highest rate you would pay on your capital gains would be the 24%. The proposal would be that any taxpayers making over $1 million would now pay 39.6%, or the highest marginal tax rate on those capital gains. So it's going to make capital gain planning very, very important, and has led some people to the discussion of, should I accelerate some gains into 2020 in anticipation of those rates going up. Again, this is hearsay. It's really difficult to tax plan using political discussion, right, around a campaign versus what we have actually written into law. I think for the most part, I feel pretty comfortable if that $1 million threshold is there, then the game plan becomes, how do we manage so that our income stays under that $1 million, and that may be that we want to spread gains out over a number of years, or what kind of games do we need to play to help get around some of that. For deductions, right now there is no limitation on your itemized deduction. The only thing that we have is that state and local taxes are capped at $10,000. For Texas taxpayers, it's not quite as painful. For some of your more tax-heavy states, your Californias, Illinois, and New Yorks of the world, this made a lot of really unhappy taxpayers. A lot of people paying tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, in state income tax and property tax and sales tax, and only 10,000 of that is deductible. The proposal would remove that limitation, so that's good news, but it would restore kind of an overall itemized deduction limitation. And one of the things that's been proposed is that you really can't benefit on your itemized deductions more than 28%. So even if you're a 39.6% taxpayer, you would only get up to 28% benefit of your itemized deductions, to which immediately my mind went to what a miserable thing to try and plan around, is really understanding just the calculation and what's the impact of that extra donation or dollar spent of itemized deduction, but has led a lot of people to think about maybe accelerating some charitable giving here into the end of this year. which could be accomplished not only through just direct giving to a charity of your choice, but also the use of either a foundation or a donor advised fund, which is kind of like a charitable giving piggy bank, but it allows you to take the deduction in the year that you actually put the funds into that account. Payroll taxes, this is another area that can get pretty expensive pretty quick. Right now, we pay Social Security tax. Employees pay 6.2%, employers pay 6.2% for a combined rate of 12.4. But that's on wages up to $137,700. That number is set to go up to about $142,000 in 2021. The current proposal from Biden would leave $140,000 to $400,000 exempt from Social Security tax, but any earnings over $400,000 would now become taxable at the full rate. And so for those making over $400,000, not only are you now subject to some of the higher individual income tax rates, but you're also now subject to additional FICA taxes on wages over that $400,000. Again, leave some people thinking, well, okay, so do we need to accelerate maybe some year-end bonuses? We normally pay them in January. Should we think about paying them in December, just in case? And then obviously that makes entity structure and how we pay key people an important conversation to have once we have a little bit more focus around what that might look like. And then the last thing that's created a lot of buzz has really been estate and gift taxing. So right now, an individual can transfer about $11.5 million either as a gift while they're alive or through their estate once they've passed without any consideration of estate and gift taxes. And so a married couple can transfer $23 million. But that is set to go to normalized amounts. We've heard figures all over the place, but most have kind of settled in on kind of what it was before the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which was about $5 to $5.5 million per individual or $11 million per couple. Again, still a pretty high number that leaves most people unaffected. But for those that are between $11 and $23 million of kind of overall family net worth, it certainly begs what kind of planning should be done, knowing that there is the potential for that change. The other thing is a lot of gift tax and a lot of gifting that occurs for estate planning purposes takes advantage of what's known as discounts. So for a variety of reasons, like lack of marketability or control of an entity, we might be able to discount what we've gifted. And Biden has really put in the crosshairs that he would like to really scale back and maybe eliminate the ability to take those valuation discounts on wealth transfer gifts. So really kind of what are the things we need to be mindful of? One is this is all hearsay, right? Election rhetoric is worth about as much as the paper it's written on, maybe less. And what the ultimate end result ends up being is going to be after a lot of duking it out, especially if we do have a split Congress. And so if you wanted to be strategic, you could consider accelerating income and deferring deductions. But as I mentioned, that's the complete opposite of what I mentioned earlier. Again, evaluate the timing of those charitable contributions. Review that entity choice. That's probably more of a future consideration. And then if you have over that $11 million threshold of family wealth, certainly take a look and see if there's anything you should consider before year end or before a new law is enacted. So I didn't leave a ton of time there at the end for questions, but this slide deck will be sent out and there are a few links where if you wish, there's a few webinars that BKD has hosted that will give you a little more detailed information about some year-end planning and charitable giving strategies. If you're not already receiving BKD Thoughtware, this first link, bkd.com/thoughtware, you can subscribe and receive emails from BKD with regular updates. And then I also included a few links for some pertinent articles based off of what we discussed here today.
Okay, thanks very much. Can you put it back on screen? That was a great presentation. There are a couple of chats that that you might try to answer? Let me pull them up. Can you see him? Mike Reiner asked, is there a minimum time an employee must be working remotely out of state for this provision to kick in? And that's when you were talking about they'd have to pay sales tax. And
sure. Yeah, I think that unfortunately that's where 43 states have 43 different sets of rules. And so each state is going to be different. But I would say if you're there for a few days or, you know, a lot of states have either a 1 week or a 2 week threshold. Beyond that, there's likely a filing responsibility.
That's not good news.
It's and not, no.
And how has the CARES Act impacted giving from a tax perspective, IRA 401k, and that's from Larry Harkless.
Impacted giving from a tax perspective, as far as donations from an IRA or a 401k, I don't.
Larry, are you on? Do you want to?
Hi, my good friend.
Hello, Larry.
Yeah, I was reading something about that. I don't know, it was in the Wall Street Journal, I guess this past, like a few days ago, and it was saying something about that you could actually give a gift. It was related to the CARES Act, and I didn't really understand it. So since you are on, I figured I'd ask, and you may know something about that. I haven't gotten with my accountant, Chen. I will do that to see. But this has been very informative, and thank you all for the presentation.
Sure.
Am I making sense of what I'm asking?
Yeah. The only thing that comes to I know that there is an above-the-line charitable deduction that was created by the CARES Act of $300. So normally, your charitable contributions are all relegated to your itemized deductions. And if your standard deduction is more, then you would take your standard deduction. But it did create a $300 charitable deduction that really kind of comes straight out of gross income. John, I don't know if you know of anything else.
Yeah, the only other thing I could think of is, the deferral of the required minimum distributions.
Yeah.
For 20, because I don't think you're required to take those in 2020. And then, of course, you've got, I don't think this is a CARES Act deal. You've got the potential to move $100,000, directly out of your IRA to a charitable organization.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what they were kind of alluding to, but I was just kind of wanted to clarify that. But that actually makes sense. And the reason I was asking is that I'm in academics and I'm starting a new podiatry school and I need some cash for people to give. And so I was just looking at that from that perspective. And that's why I was asking, because if it is, that could be a good thing. And they were kind of saying that if it wasn't for your relatives or anything, and I did see something about the $100,000 if they really wanted to give that. And with the market being up right now and everything, so it may be a good time that they want to give that now versus later, if that makes sense. So that was my question. I appreciate the input.
Yeah, and the benefit of that is that $100,000, counts towards your required minimum distribution. Of course, if you're not really required to do that in 20, but certainly, 2021, if that comes back where you do have to take those required minimum distributions out of your IRA, up to $100,000 of that can be funded directly to a charity, and it counts towards your taking the money out of the IRA that you're supposed to under the IRS guidelines.
Yeah, okay. And I think they were saying that it was deductible from your income too. I guess if it was coming out of there, then it would come directly out of your income as well.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
We are out of time. If any of you want to stay on, if you've got questions, feel free. Do you all have a couple more minutes to answer any questions?
Sure.
Does anybody want to pop in with a question or two?
I do. Go ahead, Melissa.
Go ahead. There's a question for John.
Oh, go ahead.
John, on the PPP loans, the compensation that is paid to PPP is not deductible. That's fine. It's at least at this point. What happens to retirement plan calculation on that compensation? Do you have any idea?
I have not. That's a great question. And this is why I told you couldn't answer it. You couldn't ask any questions. I have not heard that addressed in anything. My guess, and it's total guess, would be that we still count those wages for compensation. You know, they're still going to be taxed to the individual. So, you know, yeah, still going to show up on their
section 415 and so forth that comes into effect. That bothers me.
Yeah, still going to show up on their W-2s as, you know, as taxable income. So I don't think my instinct tells me it should not affect, retirement plan limits for those people.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? Melissa, did you have a question?
There are two questions, additional questions in the chat. Mike Moskowitz with Frost Bank says, when we file our 2020 taxes, which plan is in place, Biden or Trump?
Trump. So, the 2020 tax laws are what they are. The new administration doesn't start till 2021. And so any new laws would potentially impact the 2021. Although my gut tells me we probably get one extra year here and then anything probably impacts 2022, although they could retroactively go back to the beginning of 2021.
Yes, that is, makes it very muddy. Dr. Cliff Porter asks a healthcare tax question. Do you anticipate changes for how direct primary care will be treated under the new administration?
Who knows? I would assume Cliff is really probably asking more about is that view, as far as deductibility or ability to use HSA or FSA funds to pay for direct primary care. I don't know, only because there's probably a broader healthcare agenda that likely would impact how Congress and the Treasury would want to view direct primary care.
All healthcare solutions are in my clinic. I can solve everything.
May I ask one more question? This is the grants that are given by local governments. How are they going to be taxed? Because we talked about HHS. What about the grants that are given by the local government? Bexar County did, Tarrant County did. What's going to happen to those?
Yeah, my guess would be those are taxable income.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, for taxable entities, unless you're a tax exempt already, those should be income. You know, and if you receive a $10,000 grant and you spend the $10,000 on expenses, then, you're really at net zero on that. Because if you think about it, even Nerman, somebody like you would appreciate this, and now we're going to put everybody to sleep. But you can run, if the PPP expenses are deductible, I mean, we could run into basis issues.
I know. S corporations, partnerships, definitely.
Yeah, you run into basis issues if you don't count that as income.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. True.
Okay.
Fun stuff.
What about Sharon? Did you have a question? Let's see. Does somebody have their chat open?
I have addressed everything. That
thank you for a great presentation. Sarah
yeah.
Logan.
Yeah, single audit. Right.
Okay. Let's read. Depending on the ultimate source of the money, they can be counted into the federal grant threshold for single audit as well.
Right, yeah.
She's a BKD-er. We've got Stephanie Bostic and Sarah's up in Austin in their Austin office, and Stephanie's here. So they also are smart folks. So with that, thank you so much, you guys. You did a great job. I think everybody got lots of information. And what I'm gonna do, we have their permission. I will send out their PDF information that they gave us. I'll send it with my email that I disperse tomorrow. Okay, so that's it. And everybody have a great rest of the week. Talk to you later.
Thank you.
That was really good. Thank you.
Yeah. Bye.